and this rose to 47% when the respondents were interviewed again 6 or 7 months later. The researchers calculated, based on current infection estimates, there could be as many as 7 million people worldwide with parosmia as a result of COVID-19. Dr. Dweka Burgess-Watson of Newcastle University, who has been studying the psychological impact of parosmia, says this is on a scale that we've never seen before. Nor is it just a problem of the nose. Dr. Burgess-Watson says it can have a profound impact on your quality of life, from how you eat to how you socialize or engage with significant others, down to the level of whether you actually feel safe going out of your house or not. Leslie Matthews, a 52-year-old from Bolton, lost her sense of smell after catching COVID-19 in January. It started coming back in August, but most toiletries and foodstuffs smell alien to her. She says, "I have two main distorted smells. The first is a chemical type smell, which is present in most toiletries and carbonated drinks. All fragrance and aftershaves have the same disgusting smell, which makes even passing people when shopping intolerable." She notes, "The second is what I can only liken to the awful smell of a rotten fruit. All meats, cooked or otherwise, smell of this. Again, along with anything toasting, roasting or fried." Because so many foods trigger her parosmia, Leslie Matthews' diet is currently restricted to a handful of safe foods, including porridge, scrambled eggs, poached salmon, grapes and sultanas. And she feels nauseous within seconds of someone switching on a toaster. She says, "I can't go into a coffee shop and I'm constantly making excuses not to socialize, as it is no longer a pleasant experience." Restricted eating and weight loss is common among those with parosmia, Watson says. Other people start overeating because their altered sense of smell leaves them feeling unsatisfied after meals. Also common is an altered perception of body odor, both one's own and other people's. Watson says, "That can lead to a loss of social intimacy, either because you're too scared to be in the company of others or you find the company of others triggers your parosmia," adding, "I have seen cases of people feeling that they had to leave their friends because they couldn't stand the smell of them. How do you tell the person you love that you find the smell of them disgusting?" One of the worst cases she recently encountered was a person whose parosmia was triggered by the smell of fresh air. Dr. Dweka Burgess-Watson says, "They literally couldn't even move from room to room in their own house. If they walked outside, they felt the disgusting smell of the air permeated everything." The good news is that scientists are beginning to unpick the molecular mechanisms of parosmia, which could eventually lead to better ways of treating it. On the roof of the nasal cavity, about 7 centimeters behind the nostrils, is a thin membrane studded with specialized cells called olfactory sensory neurons, which capture odor molecules from the air we breathe in and out and send electrical signals to the brain area that processes them. Infections such as COVID-19 can damage these neurons. The current leading theory is that they regenerate. Miswiring and disordered signaling can occur, resulting in parosmia. Chrissy Kelly, founder of the smell loss charity Absent, who has suffered from parosmia since developing a sinus infection in 2012, says, If there is anything amiss with the whole chain of command among the olfactory nerves, then the brain cannot receive a complete signal. She adds, that's when you get these people reporting strange smells that they can't really describe, that are difficult to pin down. Triggers vary from person to person, but many of the same substances often crop up. Coffee, meat, onion, garlic, eggs, chocolate, shower gel, and toothpaste. Separate research by Dr. Jane Parker of the University of Reading and colleagues is beginning to shed light on why these substances are so problematic. In recent experiments, they broke the aroma of coffee down into its constituent molecular parts and ran them under the noses of people with parosmia and unaffected volunteers. This showed that parosmia is not linked to a person's ability to smell. Rather, there are certain compounds that evoke feelings of disgust in many people with parosmia, but which unaffected people tend to describe as pleasant. Many contain sulfur or nitrogen, although not all such compounds are triggers. They also tend to be detectable by the human nose at very low concentrations. The most frequently reported trigger in coffee was 2-furanmethaninethiol, which unaffected participants described as roasty, popcorn, or smoky smelling. Parker says many people with parosmia describe it as just new coffee. That's how my coffee smells now, adding, others described it as awful or disgusting. They've never smelled anything like it before. The fact that there's a common set of triggers suggests people are not imagining the unpleasantness that they're experiencing. It also supports the miswiring hypothesis, although if this is occurring, it seems not to be happening at random. Further research may determine why these triggers elicit such a strong parosmic response and possibly inform future treatment. For now, Dr. Watson recommends that anyone suffering from parosmia write a list of all their triggers and stick it somewhere that other household members can see it, so they can help them avoid these substances or find alternatives. For instance, many of the compounds that Parker and her colleagues have identified are created during the chemical reaction that gives roasted, fried, or toasted food its distinctive flavor. Different cooking techniques might render the same foods less offensive. Another unanswered question is how long those recovering from COVID-19 can expect their parosmia to persist. Dr. Parker says the people that had it pre-COVID were taking anything from 6 months to 2 or 3 years to recover, so it's a long process. Kelly says for some individuals, certain objects may never smell precisely how they remember them, but that doesn't mean their quality of life won't dramatically improve. She says, you have to look for healing and for a quality of life that makes you feel good about your day-to-day experiences. She adds, that's got to be the yardstick for recovery.
Midstream.
The Israeli occupation forces face a real challenge in the city and camp of Jenin, up north of the city, where the Israeli aggression is being met with the form of resistance that scares Israel the most, live bullets and homemade Molotov instead of the good old rocks. The last of these clashes occurred at dawn last Monday when the occupation forces infiltrated to arrest a Palestinian young man, but an armed clash erupted, resulting in the martyrdom of 5 Palestinians. Activists in the camp made their stand very clear as they announced that resistance fighters from all factions are ready to clash with the Israeli army whenever they storm their camp. Since September 6, the West Bank and Gaza Strip have gone through daily confrontations and clashes between Palestinian natives and the Israeli occupation after the heroic escape of the six Palestinian detainees from the Gilboa prison. In the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank, in retaliation to the continuous Israeli aggression, dozens of shootings targeted Al Jalama checkpoint, homemade bombs were thrown, and bullets targeted an Israeli military occupation camp in the Mount Gerizim in Nablus. Also, dozens of clashes involved stones and Molotov cocktails took place in different parts of the West Bank. Anger mounted in the Palestinian streets after Israel recaptured and tortured four of the hero detainees, especially Zakaria Zubaydi, the former commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, who ended up with a fracture in the face due to the Israeli brutality. All Palestinian factions praised the escalated confrontations in Al-Quds and the West Bank, considering them as the only option to force Israel to end its violations against the Palestinian natives and those illegally held as captives in Israeli detention centers. Meanwhile, former commander of the Jenin unit in the occupation army, Yair Falau, confirms that the city of Jenin and its camp still houses the nucleus of the Palestinian resistance in the occupied territories. This statement comes 20 years after the invasion carried out by the occupation army against the city and the West Bank under the name of the Defensive Wall. Falau suggested that the occupation army may carry out Operation Defensive Wall 2 within 6 months to a year if the situation continues as it is in Jenin. Yet, there is no comparison between the capabilities of the Israeli occupation forces and those of the resistance. But the will of the people and resistance fighters who have been going through hard times cannot be broken. They do not fear any threat. The Israeli army might be ready to storm the camp, awaiting a political decision, yet the resistance fighters in the camp will make them pay for it. Any price, no matter how low it is, will shake the Bennett government. This army cannot stand the killing of one or two of its occupation soldiers. We'll figure what happens if scores of them start falling. The world has witnessed in front row seats the current generation in the occupied territories defending Palestine. Natives of Al-Quds and Jenin camp do not have any fears and are ready for any Israeli aggression. The proof is that they daily go to the Al Jalama checkpoint and clash with the occupation. They are not waiting for the occupation to storm the camp. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Now, in the West Bank, the Israeli occupation forces face a real challenge in the city of Jenin in the north, where they are met with retaliatory live bullets rather than rocks, as in other areas when Zionists storm the rest of the West Bank. They are faced usually with stones being thrown at them by young men, but in Jenin, natives fire live ammunition at the occupation forces and armed clashes erupt. The last of these clashes occurred at dawn last Monday when the occupation forces penetrated to arrest a Palestinian youth and an armed clash erupted, resulting in the death of five Palestinians. It was not enough killing for Israelis that they later on Thursday morning, they killed a 30-year-old mother of four, Isra Huzaima, near Bab al-Silsila, a gate in occupied Al-Quds. Now, Isra, who is from southern Jenin, was accused without evidence by the Israeli occupation forces that she was trying to stab one of the soldiers. The city of Jenin and its camp still possesses the nucleus of Palestinian resistance in the occupied territories after 20 years of the invasion carried out by the occupation army on the city in the West Bank under the name of the Protective Fence. Now, this fence is falling apart, and Jenin will be the first to crush it. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and member of the Global Gathering in Support of the Cause of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Amal. Now, dozens of Palestinian gunmen roam the streets of the West Bank, especially the Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank, that they say that they are ready to repel any kind of Israeli aggression or invasion against the camp. They even called for a joint operation. All factions inside the camp called for a joint operation for the first time in many, many years. It includes the military wings affiliated with the National Liberation Movement, Fatah, with the Islamic Resistance, Hamas, and with the Islamic Jihad as well. Now, clashes have led recently to the martyrdom of several Palestinian young men and women. How has that affected the morale of the people inside of the camp?
Thank you, Marwa, for having me. Of course, it's affecting the morale of the people in Jenin, and it's not only Jenin. It's affecting the people of Palestine inside and outside the occupied territories. So any defiance for the Israeli occupation army and forces is actually a unifying stance by all the people and backed by all the people. Jenin refugee camp is considered to be liberated, as we call it, as the militants from the joint operation room is calling it, because the Israelis cannot enter the camp and cannot go with military forces to arrest anybody within the camp, even in the surrounding villages of Jenin. Any entrance or any insurgent by the Israeli military forces is going to be confronted with joint operation room, with joint militants from different Palestinian resistance groups to fight these Israelis. So it's not something that is going to be away by the Israeli wishes or even by any insurgent by the Israeli military forces. It's going to be defied, it's going to be resisted, and it's going to be actually causing them lots of casualties if they dare to enter the camp or to enter any of the villages.
Well, Dr. Ahmad, we heard from a former commander of the Jenin unit in the occupation army. He said his name is Yad Flau, and he confirmed that the city of Jenin and its camp, it still possesses the nucleus of the resistance of the occupied territories in occupied Palestine, and he somehow threatened that there will be a new defensive war. He called it Operation Defensive War 2, might happen again, similar to the one that happened in 2002, within 6 months to a year, if the situation continues as is in Jenin camp. Now, is this just cheap talk by the Falau person, or actually, because he's expected to be soon the commander of the Golani brigade in the army, or is Israel actually ready to commit a new genocide?
Well, committing genocide is there, the pattern is the process of this colonial apartheid entity since day one, even before 1948. So we wouldn't be surprised if they carry on any genocide against any of the Palestinian communities in the West Bank or Jerusalem. But the thing is, if we want to compare what happened 20 years ago and now in terms of accumulation of power, accumulation of willingness to defy the Israelis, even in the ability of the militants to fight the Israeli insurgents or invasion, and if we compare what happened to the Israeli side after 20 years, we can see that the balance of power now is weighing towards the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian militants.
Well, the observers of the conditions of Jenin camp and Al-Quds are believing that the Jenin camp right now looks a lot like the besieged Gaza Strip, which the Israeli army is unable to invade, just like you said right now. Now, reports suggest that the resistance fighters from different areas of the West Bank actually arrived into Jenin camp in trying to prevent the invasion and preparing for a battle against the Israeli enemy. What are the odds of a joint Gaza/occupied territories operation in the event that Israel actually goes and invades Jenin camp, for example?
Well, that's the thing. If they dare to invade the Jenin refugee camp, I am sure that the resistance in Gaza will also stand up with Jenin. and the rest of the West Bank as well. Remember that we still have the popular resistance everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we witnessed what happened in Beit Anan, Jerusalem, over a week ago when they invaded one of the villages in Jerusalem. And the militants stood up for them. Of course, they were more in numbers, and it cost us two martyrs, actually. But at the end, the will of the people to resist the occupation is increasing and is accelerating.
That brings to mind a very important question, since we have one more minute left. How do you think the PA, the Palestinian Authority, will deal in the situation in case there is an escalation inside of Jenin and the popular resistance goes up, stands in the face of the occupation?
Actually, Al-Aqsa Brigades had chosen their side. They're with the resistance. And they are together with the other factions in the military operation room. So the PA has no choice except to stand by the resistance. Otherwise, it will be looking, it will look very bad in front of the eyes of the people, of the Palestinians here. They do not have any choice except to support the resistance, to support their Aqsa Brigade.
Well, so,
that's the national stance that they should take if they want to stay in power a little bit longer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and member of the Global Gathering in support of the choice of the resistance, for being with us. And whether Palestine resists or not, we stand by the side of Palestine and by the right to defend their own soil and their liberties. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Bahrain opened a new Israeli embassy and how the population, the public, is revolting against it.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
The first official visit by an Israeli minister, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, inaugurated the Israeli embassy in Manama and met the Bahraini King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. Now, the official Bahraini news agency reported that King Hamad reviewed with Lapid the course of bilateral relations and the steps that contribute to the strengthening areas of cooperation between the two countries in light of the signing of the Declaration of Support for Peace and the Abraham Accord Agreement. Yes. He said peace, while Palestine just held several different funeral processions last week alone for the natives that were killed by the occupation's bullets. No shame whatsoever. The visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain can be summed up in one word: treason. This is how the Bahraini people feel about it, and how every Arab, Muslim, and free soul on this planet actually feels. No king, emir, or president will ever be able to remove Palestine from the hearts and minds of the people, and they will all never wash the stain of this crime from their hands. Al-Khalifa regime betrays Palestine in this following report.
Demonstrations against normalization continue in Bahrain, coinciding with the visit of the Israeli entity's foreign minister Yair Lapid, voicing their refusal to open an Israeli embassy on their soil. The Bahraini security forces had suppressed similar demonstrations in the capital, Manama, and in several cities after they roamed the streets condemning normalization during the past week. On the day of the visit, Bahraini National Initiative Against Normalization affirmed its complete rejection of normalization with the usurping entity. The initiative considered in a statement under the title No Welcome to the Occupying Criminal that Lapid's desecration of Bahrain's land comes in light of the strong rejection of the proud Bahraini people who remain loyal to their central cause, pointing out that the Palestinian cause is the compass of the conflict in the region and that the Israeli entity is a satanic seed that has been planted in the side of the Arab world to keep the latter in a state of permanent depletion, keeping it away from progress, development, and prosperity. The initiative called on the authorities of Bahrain to immediately stop slipping towards normalization, which constitutes a stab in the back of the Palestinian people and its active forces and its militant factions, calling on all groups of the Bahraini people to renew their rejection of this normalization with the enemy and to continue to stand by the Palestinian people and support them in order to liberate their land and establish their independent national state on their entire national territory with Al-Quds as their official capital. Meanwhile, all Palestinian factions and pro-resistance factions across the Arab and Islamic world condemned this act of normalization by the Bahraini rogue regime, summing up the visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain in one word: treason. All the while, Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa blatantly considered that his country's normalization with the Israeli occupation entity is a, quote, historic achievement that contributes to advancing the peace and stability process in the Middle East, end quote. The king's brazen remarks came as Palestine held seven different funeral processions for natives killed by the occupation's bullets during the same week of the Israeli foreign minister's visit to his country to open the notorious embassy on Bahraini soil.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini activist. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Al-Fayez. Now, rogue regimes in multiple Arab countries that had normalized ties with the Israeli entity are pinning their hopes on the U.S. I need to please Washington by this kind of normalization, the last of which was actually Bahrain when it welcomed Israeli foreign minister, as we just saw in the report, Yair Lapid, who inaugurated an Israeli embassy in Manama and met with the Bahraini king, Hamad bin Isa Al-Khalifa. Does the king not care whatsoever about the public sentiment in this matter? I mean, is he not concerned about his nation's security in any way possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for inviting me. Well, you just said that the Sarog regime, the Al-Khalifa regime, have no legitimacy whatsoever. And the king, so-called king, the ruler of Bahrain, is taking decision on behalf of himself and his family, not on behalf of the people. The people, is against the normalization of the Zionist entity. And our people have protested on the street for the past days, flagging the opposition to such step. Now, when we talk about security and stability, Al-Khalifa does not look at the stability of the country and security of Bahrain, but they look at the security of their regime, the Al-Khalifa ruling regime, and they believe it will be more secured with the relationship with this entity, the Zionist entity, as there is a step from the United States to leave Middle East soon.
Well, Mr. Al-Fayez, the February 14 Revolution Youth Coalition in Bahrain denounced the planned visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain, holding the Bahraini regime responsible for the consequences of the visit. Now, the coalition also emphasized the need for all forms of resistance against normalization until the concluded normalization agreements are cancelled completely with the entity. Can this be understood as a mobilization for the first armed resistance in Bahrain? That's just me asking, because I read it and read it again, and I was like, well, this is new. What do you think?
Well, the leadership of Bahrain movement, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasem, decision until this moment is to stay peaceful. Now, this with regard to the democratic transformation that the opposition and the people of Bahrain demanded for the past 10 years, actually more than 10 years, but since the 14th of February revolution. Now, with the Zionist regime being in the picture and the equation, this could change the whole equation. But, 14th 1905 coalition or other movement, they have always such option on the table, but they will not take it in a practice unless it's decided by Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim. We will resist politically, we will resist on the media, we will resist on the ground by protesting, but mobilization of armed resistance is a decision of Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim, and I would advise everyone to read his statements and to follow what he is saying, because he could take a decision if that's needed to secure Bahrain and the interest of this Ummah, the Arabic and Islamic Ummah.
Well, Palestine viewed this visit as an encouragement of Israeli crimes against its people. Mind you, on the same week which the visit actually happened, there were seven Palestinian natives that were killed with live bullets by the Israeli entity, one of which actually a 30-year-old mother of four in the occupied Al-Quds. After such humiliating normalization, what role do these puppet regimes think that they can play to protect Palestine, as they always say they are doing?
Well, that's a fake statement. They always say it change the direction of their agenda. Their agenda is to have a relationship with Israel, the Zionist entity, the Zionist regime at this point of time, because the United States have almost reached a decision to withdraw from our region, the Middle East region. The ruler of Bahrain will last think about Palestine. He will never put that in his political calculation at all.
Well, Mr. Fayez, on the outskirts of Manama, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that protesters burned tires, they protested, they tried to voice their let's say they tried to be as vocal as possible to say that they do not accept this kind of normalization, especially against the Al-Khalifa regime. We saw a hashtag on social media that says hashtag Bahrain rejects Zionists in Arabic. It was trending all week long. What do you think will be the role of the new Israeli embassy in Manama in the event the opposition decided to face off with the Bahraini regime to inverse this normalization? What can the embassy do when it has a foot inside of Manama?
Well, look, the anger is piling inside Bahrain. The people are very angry. They've been protesting for the past 3-4 days. A momentum that's going up high. And we believe the Israeli have come to Bahrain because Al-Khalifa regime needed extra support from United States and Britain to counter the people's demand of democratic transformation. But the interest of the Zionist regime is to counter Iran as a growing power that leads the resistance in our region, in the Middle East region. Now, we hear many statements from Israeli officials as well as Bahraini officials that they will have a military and security ties, and this could lead to a conflict, could lead to make Bahrain as a conflict area. God forbid, if that happened, the Israeli will not be able to defend their ally, Al-Khalifa regime, because they can't defend themselves.
Well, this has to be seen, especially in the upcoming weeks when protests are being called upon by the Bahraini people and all activists around the world as well to protest against this decision by the Al-Khalifa regime in Bahrain. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini activist, for joining us from London to talk about this issue. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Train.
us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
Huge spending on the military has undermined U.S. economic growth. Increased spending on defense meant less funding allocated to education and other socio-economic programs. This misallocation of resources was a major reason the U.S. economy was slowing down, made worse by COVID-19 pandemic and the trade war between the United States and China. We're prepared for you an article written by Ken Moak. Ken Moak taught economic theory, public policy, and globalization at university level for 33 years. The article is titled, Why Majority of Americans Support Costly Foreign Policies. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Democrats and Republicans may be at each other's throats when it comes to domestic policy, spending, and the size of U.S. government. But they are on the same page on foreign policy, protecting American supremacy or stifling any country that is in a position to challenge U.S. interests. In doing so, the U.S. government has spent lavishly and demanded that its allies do the same to stifle the purported China-Russia threat. Former President Donald Trump renamed the Asia-Pacific region Indo-Pacific, increasing Freedom of Navigation Operations, or FONOPs, and reviving the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad. Donald Trump also demanded that NATO allies increase defense spending to 2% of their gross domestic product, or GDP. Current President Joe Biden only carried on with Donald Trump's foreign policies on China and Russia, but has in fact intensified them. Joe Biden wanted to formalize and expand the Quad into a military alliance that would include South Korea, Vietnam, and others. However, huge spending on the military has undermined U.S. economic growth. Increased spending on defense meant less funding allocated to education and other socio-economic programs. This misallocation of resources was a major reason the U.S. economy was slowing down, made worse by the COVID-19 pandemic and U.S.-China trade wars. Escalating tensions in the Asia-Pacific region and politicizing the origins of COVID-19 have worsened the security environment, climate warming, and the pandemic. Holding frequent Freedom of Navigation Operations, or FONOPs, in the Asia-Pacific region has triggered an arms race of some sort between the United States and China. Each country is spending more and more on weapons development and weapons production. The Freedom of Navigation Operations and China's tit-for-tat response have a real possibility of turning the situation into a hot war. says U.S. foreign policies are, still the majority of the American public support them. For example, most American farmers, the most harmed by the trade wars, supported Donald Trump and his China policies because they wrongly believe China is a threat to U.S. national interests. This raises the question, why do most Americans support these self-inflicting harmful policies? One answer is that the so-called yellow peril narrative is not far below the skin for many Americans, believing China is a national economic and national security threat. Another is the role of groups that benefit from confrontational policies. U.S. foreign policies have turned out to be hugely profitable not only for the military-industrial complex, but also for the financial institutions, for the think tanks and the media. For example, weapons producers require large loans from banks to fulfill contractual obligations. Publishing subjective news about adversaries increased readership. Think tanks and pundits received large rewards to spin the anti-Chinese rhetoric. So there is real incentive for these groups to cheer and to lobby the government to implement confrontational policies. A case in point is how the military-industrial complex has succeeded in inventing an enemy, shaping public policies by manipulating public opinion against it, making generous election campaign donations to both major political parties, and dispersing weapons production across the country. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the United States turned against the Soviet Union, accusing it of expanding wrong ideology to Europe and to the world. The United States first instituted the Marshall Plan, showering countries with money that were willing to toe the line on American values and ideals. The recipients were also required to spend the funds on U.S. goods and services. The United States then established the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, a military alliance composed of democratic Western nations to counter Soviet Union. The formation of NATO proved profitable for the military-industrial complex because it could not only sell arms to the United States, but to its allies as well. However, spending more on defense against the perceived enemy undermined economic growth at home because less was allocated to education and to other socio-economic programs. At the same time, escalated tensions with the former Soviet Union heightened the security risk in Europe and at home. The Soviet Union responded with the establishment of the Warsaw Pact, a military club consisting of itself and Eastern European countries. The conflicts between US and Western Europe and the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe led to the Cold War, under which both sides spent huge amounts of money on defense. The collapse of the former Soviet Union thus brought joy to Americans because it was supposed to generate a peace dividend. They thought the money that was being spent on weapons would be reallocated to education, to healthcare, and employment creation programs. However, the opposite was true. Instead of bringing economic growth, the economy slowed down. This was because the states that depended on defense spending, such as California, turned into economic basket cases. Furthermore, declining military spending hurt the bottom line of the military-industrial complex, forcing them to lay off workers. To reverse the economic and financial misfortunes, an enemy had to be created. China became the ideal candidate because it was Asian, and most important of all, in a position to challenge America's hegemony in almost, if not all, fields. China's successful economy with Chinese characteristics, development architecture, allowed the country to become a near-peer power to the United States. The Asian power was able to reject the U.S.-imposed world order with the United States in most, if not all, fields, including in technology and military. China's rise was unacceptable to both the U.S. Democrats and U.S. Republicans, in that foreign policies were configured to maintain global dominance and protect national security. What's more, politicians on both sides of the political divide were obligated to defend the military-industrial complex's interests. Politicians, particularly those sitting on the Congressional Armed Services Committees and representing weapons-producing states, received generous campaign donations from the military-industrial complex. This was meant to influence the lawmakers to make favorable decisions. It worked, as the overly bloated U.S. defense budget of more than $750 billion attests. The politicians gained because they were seen as bringing home the bacon or looking after the nation's interests. Increasing weapons purchases translated into greater economic and employment opportunities. Anti-China politicians were also seen as the so-called patriots, defending America from its enemies, though no country has ever threatened the United States. Demonizing China was largely responsible for Donald Trump winning the White House race in 2016. Anti-China and anti-Russia sentiments were manipulated by politicians with the help of the media and pundits. For instance, the Washington Post published the allegation that the coronavirus had caused the COVID-19 pandemic was actually leaked from Wuhan Institute of Virology, without bothering to verify the claim. The same was true on other issues. The media and pundits kept on accusing the Chinese government of committing genocide and forced labor in Xinjiang without any credible evidence. Indeed, it could be argued that the charges did not make much sense and were contrary to what was happening on the ground. So there is no surprise that U.S. politicians, senior officials, and even presidents acted as arms salesmen, influencing allies and friends to buy American-made weapons against China and other like-minded governments. As indicated earlier, weapons manufacturing is big business, at least for the few that benefited directly from it. Whether U.S. confrontational foreign policies serve the national interest would depend on one's perspective. But there is evidence to suggest that these policies have heightened national security risks, undermined economic growth, widened the gap between the rich and the poor, and increased poverty. The trade wars with China have worsened U.S. economic woes, increasing production costs and consumer prices. Worse, the U.S. trade deficit with China has actually increased, and manufacturing activities decreased, the very reasons for the trade wars. Focusing on war and aggression instead of education and healthcare has diluted the quality and productiveness of the American labor force. In the era of globalization, this is a no-no because poor quality and unhealthy workers will not be able to compete in the world market.
Every year, hundreds of Americans lose their lives due to violence and shooting. estimates show that more than 90% of crimes is committed by men. Crimes from mass shooting to murder, armed robbery, and rape. But what is the reason behind this overwhelming amount of violence in American society? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Perhaps to understand the culture of violent masculinity in America, one must look into the myth that being a real man means putting up a false front and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Stay with us as in this episode of Aperture, Tough Guys provides a stunning look at the violence boys and young men routinely receive from virtually every corner of the American culture. From television, movies, video games, advertising, the sports culture, and U.S. political culture. Don't go away.
Deadliest mass shooting in American history.
You are just joining us. Two young men apparently dressed in long black trench coats opened fire at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
When it comes to violence, it's almost like there are two Americas.
It's horrific. I can't even put it. You can't put it into words.
There's the America that recoils in horror whenever a brutal mass shooting erupts onto our television screens, shocked by the level of destruction and suffering that just a few individuals are capable of visiting upon so many innocent people.
Police say that the gunman opened fire in a theater during a showing of that latest Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises.
And then there's the America that can't seem to get enough of violence as a form of entertainment and ritual, a seemingly endless appetite for ever-intensifying spectacles of all-out brutality and carnage. The question is what sort of relationship, if any, these two Americas have to one another. And if we're serious about answering that question, we need to stop chasing symptoms and take a good look at a truth that's been hiding in plain sight all along. That when we talk about violence in America, whether it's real or imaginary, we're almost always talking about violent masculinity. I'm Jackson Katz, and for more than 25 years, I've worked on both a personal and an institutional level to engage men directly in the effort to prevent men's violence against women and children. The reason I work with and focus on men is simple, because for the most part, violence is a men's issue. The statistics tell the story. 86% of armed robberies are committed by men. 77% of aggravated assaults are committed by men. 87% of stalkers are men. 86% of domestic violence incidents resulting in physical injury are perpetrated by men. 99% of rapes are committed by men. Men commit approximately 90% of murder. And over the past 30 years, 61 of the last 62 mass shootings have been committed by men. But while these numbers are striking, they rarely, if ever, come into play in mainstream discussions about violence.
After every event like this, the questions always are the same. What causes this kind of a shooting? How can this happen? How can they be stopped?
During hours and hours of exhaustive reporting, commentators seem to go out of their way to find gender-neutral ways to talk about this violence.
The shooters in Aurora, the shooters in Newtown,
the Connecticut shooter,
the Aurora shooter,
the alleged shooter, teenage psychopath,
mass murderers,
the suspect,
that kid,
this punk,
this murderer.
The male perpetrators become shooters or murderers or assailants or killers or suspects or psychopaths.
It's kids killing kids in the heart of America.
Violence committed by boys becomes kids killing kids and youth violence.
Here is a revealing and frankly horrifying picture of youth violence in America.
It doesn't seem to matter that girls are kids and youths too, but only commit a fraction of these kinds of crimes. And this baseline failure to acknowledge gender has a big effect when the discussion turns to other supposed causes of violence.
Violence in the entertainment culture.
Bloody games, gory movies, brutal TV shows.
Call of Duty or Halo.
Mental health issues, the faith issues.
Autism or Asperger's syndrome.
You're blaming the gun.
Their mom and their dad.
Substance abuse.
Mental health, violent games, violent movies.
I want to blame the real culprit.
Alex.
Suicide pills.
Alex.
Mass murder pills.
We hear very little, if anything, about why it is that girls and women also live in a culture saturated with guns and media violence, also suffer from mental illness, also come from dysfunctional families and have substance abuse problems, yet don't commit anywhere near the amount of violence boys and men do. In other cases, the perpetrators disappear altogether.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
You see this a lot in the mainstream discussion about so-called violence against women. The fact that men are responsible for somewhere around 98% of this violence simply evaporates. We hear about women being harassed, abused, assaulted, or raped. Men are nowhere to be found. And the result of all this is that instead of seeing men's violence against women as a men's issue, we see it as a women's issue and focus most of our attention on how to help victims and survivors after the fact. A failure all the more glaring given that mainstream media outlets have no problem at all taking gender seriously when women are the ones doing the violence.
Teenage girls involved in violent fights.
A fight between two young girls breaks out on the playground.
More and more teenage girls are getting involved in violent fights.
When girls and women act out violently, their gender becomes the story. The same way race becomes the story with men of color.
The horrific murder rate in Chicago. Does it have to do with guns or race?
When men of color rape women or shoot people or blow things up, race and culture move to the forefront of the story, crowding out the fact that the vast majority of the perpetrators under consideration, no matter what color they are men. All this is partly a function of how dominant ideologies work linguistically to conceal the power of dominant groups. For example, when we hear the word race in the United States, we tend immediately to think about African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, South Asians. And when we hear the term gender, we tend to think of women. In each case, the dominant group, white people, men, don't get examined, as if white people don't belong to some racial grouping, as if men don't have a gender. In other words, we always focus on the subordinated group and not on the dominant one. And that's one of the ways that the power of dominant groups isn't questioned, by remaining invisible.
There are young men involved in these things. There's a lot of testosterone there.
And on those rare occasions when the subject of men does make its way into mainstream discussions about violence, there's this common refrain that men's violence is all about testosterone and our prehistoric role as hunter-warriors were just programmed to be violent.
What is it about the testosterone of being a young man that makes this come to this gun violence head so often?
Why does it seem that these mass shooters are boys and not girls?
Really, it goes back to hunter-gatherer days.
Yeah. You hear another version of this in the common refrain, boys will be boys.
Let boys be boys. They want to play rough. Don't try and over-medicate them and, you know, turn them into girls. They're boys.
No one would deny that there are biological factors that sometimes come into play with violence. The problem is when biological arguments lead people to conclude that men are just beasts who are overcome by hormonal urges they can't control, that men are incapable of making moral and ethical decisions, that boys are born hardwired to bully, rape, and murder. But perhaps the most damaging thing this kind of thinking does is that it blinds us to the fundamental role that cultural systems play in all of this.
This is a document signed by six of the major public health organizations saying that the violence in the entertainment, the level that we've attained to today, is causing increased aggressive behavior among some children.
For decades, experts and government officials have been arguing that we need to take a closer look at the relationship between violence in the culture and violence in the real world.
And in the days since the heartbreaking tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, I also tasked the Vice President with leading an effort to come up with a comprehensive set of serious proposals to keep our children safe, including strengthening school safety, improving mental health care, and addressing a culture that too often glorifies guns and violence.
This focus on the culture of violence in America took on new and bipartisan urgency in the wake of Adam Lanza's cold-blooded murder of 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. But unfortunately, it quickly descended into a distracting and false debate between defenders of the gun industry and defenders of the entertainment industry.
There exists in this country, sadly, a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and stows violence against its own people through vicious, violent video games.
On one side, we've had the gun industry blaming movies and video games.
We have blood-soaked films out there, like American Psycho, Natural Born Killers, that are aired like propaganda loops on splatter days.